This morning we're going to look at the story of Gideon, and because it covers over two chapters, I'm not going to read the passage. I will highlight the story so that you can know the events that are taking place. And in case you're worrying, no, this is not a sales pitch for the Gideon's organization. As much as I like that organization, this is something entirely different this morning. And looking briefly at the events that took place in Israel, we see that in chapter 6 there are certain events recounted, the first of which is that Israel does what is evil in the eyes of the Lord. After they fall into gross sin, God hands them over. It says he delivers them into the hands of the Midianites. For 7 years they live in caves and rocks and strongholds because they can't take care of themselves. Finally, after 7 years, they're like us, rather slow to learn, they call out to the Lord for deliverance. God sends a prophet, but he doesn't quite have the message that the Israelites wanted. What he does is confront them with their sin, force them to focus upon the fact that they have been and continue to be, in spite of their calling upon God for deliverance, in rebellion to him. But God doesn't leave it there. He doesn't leave it in their court. He sends the angel of the Lord to Gideon. He speaks to Gideon, reveals his plans, and through Gideon delivers Israel from Midian. Don't get confused, please, with Gideon and Midian. There's a drastic difference. My children have a little book about Gideon. It talks about Gideon and the Midianites, and it goes back and forth rhyming on Gideon and Midian. Don't get lost. The truth is that God does deliver the Israelites. Not because of what they've done, not because of the things that they're doing, but because of his goodness and in his power. And that's the focus of this whole message this morning. It's the focus of the passage. And what I would like you to do this morning is to put yourself in Gideon's position. As we go through what the angel of the Lord takes Gideon through, I think we need to be there with him because, in fact, today we are there. You see, Gideon is a picture of what we are to be like as we relate to the Lord. In the beginning, you see in the first point that Gideon faces a hopeless situation. The reality is that Israel has been conquered. They have been overrun. They are oppressed. Looking at the reports of today's economy, you might have an easy time placing yourself in Gideon's situation. And there may be some humor in that for this morning's message, but there's no humor when you walk out the doors and you wonder about your job and you wonder about your home. You wonder about the economy of Washington, D.C., which until this point has apparently been freed from any sort of economic ripples or earthquakes. But today isn't. Look for a moment at the situation of Israel. They've been conquered. The Midianites come and destroy their economic base. They can't grow food. We're facing some economic uncertainty ourselves. However, it's not just economics for the Israelites. It's their life. Because the food that they no longer can grow is the food they need to eat when winter comes. As they see the Midianites camping out on their fields full of grain and wheat, they don't look at it as, well, gee, I can't afford those luxuries. They see they can't afford to eat. They have nothing to eat. They're going to starve. They're forced to live in caves because the Midianites come and destroy not only the grain and the animals, but the houses, the towns. This is war. America has never suffered a war other than civil war and the War of 1812 and the Revolutionary War on our own territory. For nearly 130 years, we've been freed of any sense of fear for our own property. We look in Colombia and we have houses that are astounding if you compare them to other parts of the country. I think we have a very difficult time understanding the mentality of those who live in caves. But I think today we're getting a glimpse of that as we begin to wonder, will we have our houses? Maybe more close to home, Gideon himself was threshing wheat in a wine press. Not because it was a convenient place or a comfortable place to thresh wheat, but because he was fearful that if the Midianites knew he had grain, they would come and steal it. So he was hiding essentially in a hole in the rocks, trying to secretly thresh out the grain he needed to have to survive through the winter. Now, looking at their situation, realizing the hopelessness that they had, one thing leaps out to our minds. God is not with them. Now, Gideon's perspective is this, and that of all the Israelites, in fact, God has abandoned us. And it seems like a neat conclusion to draw because it frees us from responsibility. In our situation today, we might be thinking, gee, is God abandoning us? We have dreams and hopes. We feel oppressed. Where's God? Has he abandoned us? But I challenge that view because it's not true. Gideon, in saying God had abandoned Israel, was protecting himself. Because Gideon was not abandoned by God. Look at the facts that are present here for a moment. The first fact is that Israel sinned. Finally, after 7 years, they cry out to the Lord, hey, I think I've had enough of this. You know, we've tried the other ways of getting around without having to come to you. We know we can't do it on our own. Maybe it's time to approach the Lord. I don't know about you, but that sounds familiar to me. If I exhaust all my resources, then I begin to seek the Lord. But that's the wrong way to go about doing it. What does God do? Does God abandon them? No. He sends a prophet. What's the prophet do? Well, he doesn't give the answer that the Israelites wanted. The answer they wanted, and the answer that I oftentimes want is, gee, I'm sorry. Let me fix that for you. What the prophet says is, I am your God. I brought you out of Egypt. I snatched you from the oppression you were facing. I gave you this land and pushed the enemies out from before you. I told you what not to do. But you didn't listen. And the prophet stops. That's the message of the Lord. That's not a very comforting message. But you know, it's the message they needed. Because their problem was they were in sin. The only solution to their oppression wasn't a military victory. It was to get rid of their sin. And that's exactly what God pointed out to them. That's grace. That's not abandonment. But then he doesn't even stop there. God, in his gracious goodness, sends the angel of the Lord to Gideon. You see, Israel had not been abandoned by God to face their oppression alone. Israel, in turn, had abandoned God to seek the pleasures of their sin because they wanted to. And because of that, they faced a hopeless situation because they had removed the only hope they had. They had not gone to the Lord who could deliver for 7 years. But as I study this story, one of the things that gives me a wonderful sense of relief, you can't see it because I'm not smiling, but it's there. There is a wonderful sense of relief that goes on in this story, and that is that Gideon not only faces a hopeless situation, but he belongs to a powerful God. That is point number two. I can see the pencils furiously writing. But you know what? Gideon didn't believe that he belonged to a powerful God. Again, he reminds me very much of me. And he focuses upon himself. You see, the first thing that happens here is that Gideon tries to point out to God that he's wrong. No, God, I don't have this power. I can't do that. No way. Me? Picture the scene. Gideon's hiding in a wine press. He's threshing grain because he's terrified. He's got these enemies that are coming around the area trying to take everything he's got. And this angel has the audacity to come to him and say, the Lord is with you, mighty warrior. It's right there. It's in chapter 6, verse 12. The Lord is with you, mighty warrior. He's hiding. He's terrified. He has no hope. Gideon's response is, no, you must have the wrong man. He says, me? How can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Israel. And I'm the least of my family. I can't do that. You see, Gideon remains in the wine press, both physically and mentally. And he doesn't understand who God is. He doesn't understand who God wants him to be. But God, on the other hand, sees Gideon as he will use him. Remember, in the very beginning of this interaction, the angel comes to Gideon and says this, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." Now, I don't believe there's a smile on the angel's face when he says that. I don't know how he can refrain. But there's not a smile on the angel's face because he's serious. He's speaking truth. The Lord is with you, mighty warrior. Do you feel that the Lord is with you this morning, mighty warriors and warrioresses? I'm not sure the grammar of that, but I think the point comes across. Is the Lord with you? He goes on. Gideon says, hey, not me. The angel says, wait a minute. Got the right address. Tell you what, you go in the strength that you have. You go in the strength that you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you? He goes on from there and he promises victory to Gideon. Gideon continues not to understand, not to have the power that God's giving to him. But the angel of the Lord, at this point we know that it's not just the angel of the Lord, but it's the Lord himself. Because the pronoun changes. It's no longer the Lord is with you. Now it's, am I not sending you? I will be with you. The angel of the Lord says to Gideon, I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites together. Chapter 6, verse 16. That's not just a command. That's a promise. We've switched from a declaration that you're a mighty warrior to a command to go and do what God desires for you to do to a promise that in his strength you'll accomplish the things that he tells you to do. I don't know about you, but I find tremendous comfort in that. But you know, as I read those phrases, I'm struck by how this so clearly parallels something very personally applicable to each of us. Think for a moment, where else have you heard go? Make disciples of all nations. Lo, I am with you to the end of the age. You see, Gideon's receiving a commission at this point to deliver Israel. Now, we have received a commission from our Lord to deliver the world. And it's the same commission. It's the same commission. To go and make disciples of all nations is to subdue the enemies of the Lord and to bring them through faith to relationship with him. We're not to kill the enemies of the Lord as Gideon was to kill the Midianites, but we are to subdue them. We're not to do it in our own power, because then we, like Gideon, would claim that I am the least in my clan. Because God says, lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. But God not only sees Gideon as he is, or as he will be. Gideon sees Gideon as he is. God sees him as he will be. But God graciously brings Gideon into perspective. Gideon begins to understand what it is God's going to do through him. This is where I find myself fitting most closely with Gideon, because I find myself feeling as uncomfortable as Gideon does with God's program. Think for a moment as to what happens here. The first thing God does is say, I'm the one that will bring you the victory. Go in the strength you have, am I not sending you? I will be with you. You will strike down the Midianites as one man. God teaches that he is the source of victory. If today we are facing our oppression in our own power, we are hopeless. If we're facing it on our resources, we are lost. Because our resources aren't sufficient. And God teaches that to Gideon in a very clear and stunning way. The first thing he does is he gives Gideon his word. There has been silence from God for years. The people haven't even listened to what they had before. Remember, Gideon says, they used to tell us about all his wonders. Where are they? See, they had the word of the Lord, but they didn't even listen. Now God finally ends that silence and speaks to Gideon. And that's a wonderful gift in itself. But he doesn't stop there. God's pretty good. He gives him miracles. He gives him the fleece. He gives them the consumption of an offering in a way that made Gideon realize so clearly this was not an angel, that Gideon knew he was going to die. Remember, when Isaiah sees the Lord in his temple, he says, "Woe is me, for I'm a man of unclean lips, from a people of unclean lips. I'm going to die." Gideon says, "Ah, sovereign Lord, I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." Now, he doesn't say it here, but it's clear in his mind from the way the Lord responds that he's afraid he's going to die. The Lord answers, "Peace, do not be afraid. You are not going to die." God gives his word, he gives miracles, but he also, in the end of the story, as Gideon is finally there with his soldiers and realizes just what kind of odds he faces, he gives Gideon a dream. Gideon doesn't even dream it himself. He doesn't have to. And he doesn't have to interpret it. As Gideon is on the hillside and he realizes the odds, he says, "Lord, are you serious about this? You really want me to face this many people with this few people?" And the Lord says to him, "Go down into the camp. Listen to what they have to say." And it just so happens that there are two Midianites talking. Gideon happens to be able to sneak in and sneak out and listen to them. One of them happens to say to the other, "Hey, I had a strange dream. A round loaf of barley came rolling down into the camp with such force that it knocked down a tent." The other guy says, "Hey, I know what that means." I wouldn't. God's given the victory to Gideon. That's the sword of Gideon coming into the camp, and he's going to wipe us out. God is so good to Gideon that he gives him promises and confidence. But God doesn't simply begin by building up Gideon's confidence. That would be the easy way. I could enjoy that. I would really be glad to have God give me promises and come out of the blue and say, "Hey, Steve, everything's going to be okay. Don't worry about it. I'm with you." But he doesn't do that. He doesn't even do that for Gideon. Because the first thing that God does is diminish Gideon's resources to the point that no one can take the credit for what Gideon accomplishes except God. We all tend to think of Gideon and realize how wonderful it was that God would give him the answer of the fleece, but we don't realize what God did to Gideon after that. Gideon gets ready for war. God gives him a spirit of confidence because God is there. Gideon calls out the forces, and he gets a wonderful 32,000 soldiers ready to fight for him. Now, that seems like a pretty large army to me. I wouldn't mind being in command of 32,000 people. But that's not what God does with Gideon. Because God comes to Gideon in chapter 7, verse 2, and says, "You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands, in order that Israel may not boast against me that in her own strength, that her own strength has saved her. Announce now to the people that anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead." So Gideon obeys. And his forces are cut by 22,000 men. You see, he begins with a force of 32,000 men, and God says, "No, that's too many. Tell you what, we're going to cut it back. You just tell those who are kind of scared that they can go home." Two-thirds of his army leaves. Now, this might have been a sound military strategy, but that's not what's taking place here. You might want to face an enemy with 10,000 hard, strong, committed, lean, mean people, instead of 32,000 who might be afraid and contaminate those who were prepared. But that's not what's going on here. What's going on here is what God says. "You have too many. You will boast in your own strength." And God confirms that because in chapter 7, verse 4, he goes on, and now Gideon has 10,000. God says, "Gideon, there are still too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will sift them for you. If I say this one shall go with you, he shall go. But if I say this one shall not go with you, he will not go." Well, God in his wonderful wisdom, I'm not sure Gideon would have concurred with that understanding, but God in his wonderful wisdom does what's right. And now Gideon has not 10,000, but 300 people. Do you realize that he's lost 99 out of 100 men? He began with a force of 32,000 that might have been somewhat respectable. You could almost march in a parade with that many people. He ends up with 300. Now Gideon, if he's anything like me, was really beginning to sweat. Because he began with what he thought might be able to do the job, and now he's got 300. This comes into clearer perspective for us as we look at chapter 8, verse 10, though. Because do you realize how many people Gideon was facing? Do you realize what the odds against his victory were? He began with 32,000 men, and he would have faced 135,000 soldiers. He ended up with 300 men facing 135,000 soldiers. I can understand why Gideon went to God and said, God, are you sure about this? And I'm awful glad that God gave Gideon that dream and that interpretation, because I would have said, forget it. I think I'll go back to my cave. Today, God continues to do this to us and through us. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 9. Paul gives a wonderful commentary on this. He talks about being kept from being conceited, exactly the thing that God was protecting Gideon from. And he says in verse 7, to keep me from being conceited because of these surpassingly great revelations, there was given to me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is perfected in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Are you feeling strong this morning? Are you feeling strong in your strength or in the Lord's? As you face the oppression that is hitting you square on, I don't care whether it's problems in the family, I don't care whether it's problems in marriage or whether it's employment or housing, whether it's problems in school, we're all facing something. And are you facing that in your strength this morning? When you go to whatever you go to tomorrow, whether it's work or home or school, are you going to face those challenges in your own strength? Are you looking at the 32,000 and thinking, well, we can manage. We'll have to cut back, but we can manage. Or are you like Gideon facing the 135,000 with 300? One graphic example of that today is so many missions agencies are talking about how the job can be done. We have X number of people groups and we have X number of churches. If each church would just adopt a people group, by the year 2000, we can do the job. I have some fundamental problems with that. We can't do the job, period. There's no way. God can do the job, and he can use our minimal resources to accomplish it, but we can't do the job. I don't care what job it is. And in fact, God does the job. We find in point three that Gideon is given victory. But God goes about it in a way that I don't think we're really prepared to face. At least Gideon wasn't to begin with. Because it's not just a military victory. In fact, that's sort of a secondary thing in this whole chapter. It's not that God is so concerned and consumed with giving Israel peace. He doesn't care about the physical circumstances all that much. That's not his primary concern. He's concerned, but that's not his primary concern. That's not where his focus is. Because God's focus is to restore a relationship that has been severed for 7 years. The first thing God commands Gideon to do as the angel of the Lord comes to him is not to wipe out the Midianites. The first thing God commands him to do is found in chapter 6, verse 25. That same night, the Lord said to him, take the second bull from your father's herd, the one 7 years old. Tear down your father's altar to Baal and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. Then build the proper kind of altar to the Lord your God on the top of this height. Using the wood of the Asherah pole that you cut down, offer the second bull as a burnt offering. I would have probably thought it would have been time to gather the troops and begin some training. That's not what God tells Gideon to do. Because you see, the primary battle that's taking place here is not between the soldiers of Israel and the soldiers of Midian. The battle which is the focus of this entire story is the battle between God on the one hand and the false gods on the other. This is a cosmic battle. Who is truly God? Gideon does what he is told to do, but he does it at night with 10 men to protect him. Fearful because these people mean business. In chapter 6, verse 31, we find that the people have decided that whoever has cut down this Asherah pole and has taken down this altar must die. They realize that it's Gideon. And what happens is Gideon, as the champion of the Lord, has taken on a task that needed to be done. He has challenged the god of the Amorites, Baal. He said, okay, if you're real, do something about this altar. The people come to kill him, and his father says, and listen to this carefully. You might get confused at first, but listen to the pronouns very carefully. Are you going to, this is Joash speaking to the people in the town who want to kill Gideon. Are you going to plead Baal's cause? Are you trying to save him? Are you trying to save Baal? Whoever fights for him, whoever fights for Baal, shall be put to death by morning. If Baal really is a god, he can defend himself when someone breaks down his altar. So that day they called Gideon Jerub-Baal, saying, let Baal contend with him, because he broke down Baal's altar. Baal has been slapped in the face with an iron glove. And Baal can't do anything about it, because the truth is, Baal is simply a piece of wood. He's an idol. And that's the victory that takes place here. The battle is simply a follow-through. Once this has been accomplished and God has restored relationship with the Israelites and they begin again to worship him, the war's over. It's just a cleanup action now. Gideon doesn't realize that yet, and that's why he's frightened with 300 people. But it's a cleanup action. As we come this morning to understand how to face our lives and to deal with the oppression that we have, the suffering and the difficulties that we face, who's God? Who is God? And whose God do you worship? Are you worshiping the God of the Amorites? Constantly through this story, we find that there is a cycle. There is worship and then victory. Worship and then victory. It begins with Gideon as he offers worship to God by building the altar, which he names the Lord is Peace, when he realizes that this is an angel of the Lord. It goes on again when he builds the altar that God commands him to build and has victory over Baal. And it concludes in chapter 7. Verse 15. And this is prior to the battle. The cycle begins with Gideon hearing the dream. And it says in chapter 7, verse 15, when Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he worshiped God. Maybe even right then and there in the Midianites' camp. He worshiped God. Then he went off to his men and said, hey, God's given us the victory. Don't lose sight of the fact this morning that it's not only God who is with us and God who sends, but it is God we must worship. We must be at peace with him, or we'll have no peace whatsoever. Then once Gideon understands that it's God who is at work, God gives Gideon the victory. Now it's amazing to me that the Midianites in chapter 7, verse 14, before even Gideon can say it, give the victory to God. God has given the Midianites and the whole camp into his hands. Can you imagine going into a war knowing that your enemies already know more clearly than you do that God is going to defeat them through you? Why even have the battle? Chapter 7, verse 22, we find that it says that the Lord caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. Something that strikes me as I look at Gideon standing on the hillside with three groups of 100 men. And it lists their weapons. You recall what they are. It's a light, it's a torch, it's a jug, and a trumpet. It doesn't even list a sword. When the battle begins, they break the jug and make a loud noise. They shout the sword of the Lord and the sword of Gideon. They let the lights shine and they start blowing on the trumpets. Nowhere does it say they lifted a sword from a sheath. And yet we find in chapter 8, I believe it's verse 22, the listing of the battle. Nope, it's not there. Just checking. Okay. In chapter 8, verse 10. Do you know how many men died in the first part of the battle? How many Midianites died? Gideon didn't lift a sword, but 122,000 Midianites died. They were wiped out by each other. The Lord didn't even give Gideon the satisfaction of killing the enemies themselves so that they could claim victory. He takes 32,000 men and takes them down to 10,000 men, takes those down to 300, and doesn't even let them draw a sword. Do you think God can do that with your struggles? The important thing this morning for you to realize through all this is not so much the fun of how God presents his story and the humor that God has as he delivers Israelites. The key question for us this morning is, are we a Gideon? And again, I'm not talking about a human organization. I'm talking about, are you like Gideon? There are essential elements today that you have to ask yourselves. And these are the questions I want you to face. Are you feeling abandoned and oppressed? As you sit here this morning and have come to worship, are you feeling abandoned by God? Do you wonder where in the world he could be? Are your times dry? Are you frightened because of what could happen? Are you aware of the oppression that's going on? What's the condition of your life? When you think about your life, are you focusing on the enemies? Or are you focusing on the angel? If the angel's speaking to you this morning and telling you to go and conquer the Midianites in the strength that he's given you, he's with you. Do you believe him or do you laugh? Are you trusting in the signs or asking for the signs and forgetting to trust the one who gives them? Chuck Smith tells a story. He's the pastor who started Calvary Chapel in Costa Mesa, which began a whole movement of Calvary Chapel churches. And he has one story that he tells that I really can identify with. Early on in his ministry, he was facing some very serious financial problems. And he had the promises of God that he would provide. And he went to prayer, and he sought God to take care of him. And he struggled in prayer. He didn't struggle to the point of shedding blood as tears, but he struggled in prayer. And finally, after a period of time, he could come up from prayer confident that God would answer, but with nagging doubts. See, God had given promises, and he knew that he could trust in God's promises, but he still had doubts. Does it apply to me? Shortly after he'd gotten up from prayer, there was a phone call, and he took it, and it was a friend that he hadn't seen for years. And this friend spoke on the phone about how God had laid a burden on his heart to take care of some financial needs that Chuck might have, and so he had a check in the mail. He'd already sent it. And wouldn't you know, it was for the exact amount that Chuck needed. Well, now you can imagine that Chuck was no longer walking with feet on the floor. He was about 3 feet off the ground, and so he went back to thank God and say how wonderful God was for providing his needs. But God didn't leave it there, you see, because God convicted Chuck through that prayer. Who are you trusting? I've told you. I, your God, have told you I'll take care of your needs. Isn't that enough? You left prayer feeling somewhat confident, but having doubts. A man calls you up you haven't seen for years and tells you there's this check that's in the mail that's for the right amount of money. You haven't seen the check. You don't know if he's got the funds to cash it anymore. And yet you're content and elated. You have no doubts. I give you a sign and you're happy. You don't trust me when I promise to meet the needs. Are you looking for the sign or the one who gives them? But you know, you can only look for those signs and you can only trust the one who gives them if you have peace with him. Gideon had to have peace with God before God would work. Do you have peace with God this morning? Are you at one with your Maker? Do you even know how to have peace with Him? It's only through Jesus. And it's only the God of the Bible who speaks for Himself that can give you that confidence. What God do you worship? Do you worship the God of your own making, who you can contain in a box? Or do you worship the God who speaks for Himself through this? Do you spend time getting to know Him better? Are you at peace with God? Is He your loving Father, or is He your harsh taskmaster that you have to please? Is He the love of your life, or a fearful God who has no pleasure in you? And then lastly, is God working through you to accomplish His work? You see, God didn't just restore relationship with Gideon. God restored relationship with Gideon and with Israel. Is God working through you to fulfill the commission that He's given to you in Matthew? Go make disciples of all nations. Lo, I am with you always, even to the ends of the age. Or are you content to stay in the wine press and eke out enough grain for you to survive in your relationship with the Lord?